All right.
I would like to welcome everybody to the Ward College here. This is the second year in a row that we've done it at CelestaCon. This is CelestaCon 2013. We've had a lot of good talks, including by our last speaker this weekend, Jack Green, who's going to talk about his experience while he was employed at Avalon Hill. Jack, it's so good to have you as a special guest. You and Frank Chadwick were terrific. And this is the final talk of the show. And I would like to have everybody give you a warm welcome.
Yeah, well, and actually, I'm going to focus on the reunion that I just attended. The first and possibly only reunion of Avalon Hill employees took place this summer on August 2nd, 2013. This was held at the WBC, or World Board Gaming Convention, something Don Greenwood has worked on since the passing of Avalon Hill. It was held in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. And this was the announcement. Avalon Hill reunion. For many of us, the hobby began with the products of one company. This year, WBC occurs during the 15th anniversary of the sale of the Avalon Hill Game Company to Hasbro, which ended the Avalon Con era. And if you recall, the origin started with Avalon Hill and the cooperation of the other companies. And then later they had a special Avalon Hill Game Convention, which morphed into WBC. The passing of two of their colleagues in the past year has brought many of those employees back together again in 2013 to relive the old days one more time. Join us in Hopewell on Friday afternoon at the largest gathering of Avalon Hill designers ever assembled to retell old tales. Which, by the way, here is a little list of the attendees.
I have this.
Oh, you do? Okay, I didn't know you got that. Sorry. I will also talk about when I was there, McGowan's first game box cover at Avalon Hill, the introduction of the 1829/30 railroad games to the hobby via my friend Andrew Smith, and the, so whenever you see a 1830 or one of the 18XX games being played, I have to say that I helped introduce that. The lawsuit over my only design from Avalon Hill, Bismarck, which brought against SSI, for which was strategic studies,
simulation, strategic simulations.
They ripped off my design, so I actually, they ripped off Bismarck, and it was the first computer word game. So I got that little accolade I can attest to. And then also how we produced games back in the day at Avalon Hill, and this would be in 75, 76. So I worked at Avalon Hill part-time, 75, 76, and full-time at Monarch Services, a printing firm in Baltimore that owned Avalon Hill for, and I worked there for a year and a half. I had been recruited after attending Origins 1 in the summer of 1975. This was the days of Eric Dott, Tom Shaw, Don Greenwood, and Randy Reed, and the expansion of the wargaming industry, which took place in those days. And I attended a reunion of employees organized by Don Greenwood this summer, as we started to lose some of the old guard, and for, specifically for me, it was Craig Taylor. There was a secretary there that had passed shortly after Craig Taylor, but I never knew her. And Don made a special effort to gather these people together. Now, one of the first Don's first comments was that almost a dozen former employees were part of the, quote, over the hill Avalon Hill game. He also early commented on, this company succeeded in spite of itself. Don also, just before Pershing was hired, would take them aside, and he didn't do this with me, but he later would take them aside and ask if they really wanted to work at Avalon Hill, because it was going to be low pay under poor management. And
welcome to Avalon Hill, right?
Yeah, exactly. Among those in attendance was Mick Yule, who was the developer for Bismarck and was there for a long time before he went on to a computer game company. Rex Martin, who was an editor of the General for a long time. Bruce Milligan, who was best known for All-Star Replay from Avalon Hill, but he was also the final developer on The Longest Day, which was Randy Reed's pretty much last design. Pardon?
How about that?
Yeah, I sold my copy about 2 years ago for a very nice.
The first time we played it was the shortest game of The Longest Day.
Oh, really?
The German player rolled 6-6s on the Coastal Defense Artillery.
Whoops. That's great.
Wiped out Omaha Beach. And then we got into it, and it took a long time.
So Mark Kerman was there, and I consider him probably the most single successful war game designer in the business, vice president at one of the big defense industries. So I think it's senior vice president, if I'm not mistaken. And then the venerable Richard Carroll Hamlin. Now, no one's had any contact for Richard Carroll Hamlin for ages. And so when they showed up, it was a real treat. And Richard, by the way, was claiming that he's got designs out there that he wants to produce. So you may remember he did Bull Run, he did Magic Realm, he did a couple other things. And he was productive. And there's other people who I was not familiar with, which are most of the people on that list. I heard of Charlie Keebler. I had no idea who Don Hawthorne was. I guess he's successful science fiction writer now. Now, the Avalon Hill Game Company was, for all but the first years under Eric Dodd, was housed in a separate building and not at the Hartford Road address. And I worked in the same building with Avalon Hill, which was a very, very small printing operation. They had assembly upstairs. Apparently, at one time before I got there, Avalon Hill was even located further up in the building, and then it's, I think, a six-story building. And then they came down to, I believe it was the third floor, and I worked on the second.
This is the famous Hartford Road address?
No, not at all. That's what I mean. The main business, it was at Hartford, but that main business was printing, and they must have had 100 people working there. Mm-hmm. I mean, maybe not quite that many, maybe 60, but there was a substantial operation. We were completely detached, downtown, next to, and essentially in the ghetto, and we'll get into that. And then we used to call the whole thing the plantation, okay? And then later I was reading this Greg Castigian article in which apparently people referred to Eric Dot as Papa Dot, and they referred to his son as Baby Dot, which if you go back to your Duvalier days in Haiti, you'll see the reference. Apparently they didn't do that to his face. Now, for clarification, Tom Shaw was the head of Avalon Hill. And after the Charles S. Roberts business failure in the 60s, Tom was the only employee retained. And he literally worked off the desk of Eric Dodd for some period of time. So if Eric Dodd was sitting here, Tom was over there working in that corner, keeping Avalon Hill alive. Now, Eric's business was printing. And he had a habit of buying up failing printing companies, and he had a shell game with them in taxes. At one point, he got nailed by the IRS for charging too much for printing to Avalon Hill, which he owned, from one of his printing companies, which he owned. Most of which were all under the same roof at Hartford, as I said. So, for example, I worked for Monarch Services, the main umbrella, and literally working next to me might be a guy from J&H Tool and Die, a company that had been bought out 10 years previous for whatever reason. Now, Eric did not know the game business, and he'd been the main printing arm, but he had been the main printing arm for Charles Roberts' Avalon Hill. And when Charles Roberts' firm fell on hard times, Eric literally went into the files, read the letters from fans like you and me, and he, Eric, realized that there was something here that he could make use of. Eric saved war gaming as we know it. And when I brought that up at the reunion, I said, Eric saved the... And Don said, Jack's right, because there was a lot of bad mouthing in this area, as we'll get into. As Avalon Hill recovered and was profitable, Avalon Hill got its own office down near the Baltimore train station in a vibrant area of town. That's where I work. Shootings near the building were not uncommon. It moved twice within the building. Actually, when I moved downtown from Randy Reed's house, where I was his roommate until he got married, I moved two blocks from the office, and while I was living there for 5 months, two people were murdered on my block. So it was not a nice neighborhood. Let's see. And then I moved, 76. The bad part is bad part of town is where I worked, both at Avalon Hill, which is upstairs, and for Monarch. The print part of Monarch there was a tiny part of the operation, and the rest of the printers and press helpers at the Hartford Road address referred to where I worked as Siberia. Later, another move to the next office, which I never saw, Rex Martin told a story about a female resident of a second floor apartment across the street who daily undressed in full view of the artist's office's windows. And one designer put a fake set of binoculars on the window. Now, Tom Shaw would also, once a month, would make sure he came by and he would ask the designers what they were currently working on and what the status was so that he could then go down to Hartford Road and make a report to Eric Dodd. Now, while I was there, Richard Hamlin had to campaign hard and heavy to get upper management, which was Monarch, to purchase a word processing machine, which some of you older folks may remember, which later would morph into our modern PCs and Macs. But at that time, Richard was way ahead of the curve. Randy Reed, Don Greenwood, me, later Frank Davis, well, we all knew nothing about this part of the future. We were still the old typewriters. The other thing that's interesting is both Don and Randy have told the story to me. What Don finished his first game design that he was developing, don't ask me what it was, I don't want to know what it was, but it was probably in the early 70s. And he went to Tom, and Tom got the okay, and they said, okay, we'll go ahead and produce the game. And also start getting the general out, because you're going to be doing that. He says, well, who do I give to do the artwork? No, you're doing the artwork. So they literally did not have an artist back then. You know, the guys were self-trained, which also gives you a reason when you look at some of those old games why the graphics sometimes vary between, it's because the guys were literally doing it. You know, Ruby Lith, the whole thing, no computers, obviously. Now, Don brought up and disposed the story of Gary Gygax in D&D. Avalon Hill offered to purchase the rights over lunch, and Gary said no. And that was one of the questions that was answered from the audience. One story, and this you start to get the sense why Avalon Hill is no longer around. One story concerned the interview of a game designer who wanted to do his computer game through Avalon Hill, and upper management was actually had a luncheon scheduled, and they canceled it. They said, no, we don't want to talk to this guy. That was Sid Meier, and the game was a computer civilization. Yeah.
Oops.
There was another discussion when a proposed meeting was canceled with Osprey Publishing. Osprey had wanted to make an agreement so they could do the card art for Upfront. We don't want to do that.
Yeah, imagine that, huh?
Now, an interesting story about Upfront that Greenwood brought up, and it's apropos to the game designers here, is that's his favorite game. He still plays it. He still thinks it's the best game he worked on. And the thing is that Jack, the mistake I made with Upfront is I put everything into one box. And what I should have done is put a game into the box and then had a couple variants or expansion kits or something like that come out later. Don had a couple other interesting insights. One was that he thought the Hex was dead. In fact, apparently he hasn't played a Hex game for like 20 years. You're going to have a hard time answering the quiz at the end of this. another insight that he had was he had noticed an increase in playing and attendance at WBC. We've noticed that at Gen Con there's an increase. There seems to be an increase in general for I know Consum World in Arizona, that there's been a Monster Con, there's been an increase there. But Don said, this is his quote, computers killed us off, but the internet brought us back. And I think there's a lot of truth to that. Now, Bruce Milligan was there, and Bruce advanced the Bruce Shelley idea. And Bruce Shelley was at Avalon Hill after I was there, but very nice guy. And he says that he thinks that Avalon Hill died from a lack of advertising, because the only advertising Avalon Hill did was putting ads in Boys Life. Now, Shelley has argued that SPI did a tremendous amount of advertising, which was true. I mean, heck, they were in the New York Times. I found out today they even did a television ad.
They had a two-page spread in Playboy. Yes, they did. A bunch of years, maybe like 80, 81 ranking.
Well, the point that he made was that the gamer would see these advertisements, they go down to their local store where the games were available, and they look at these kind of drab SPI boxes with, white boxes or the plastic bubble game look, and they see these nice Avalon Hill games, which was pointed out to me as the Network Harrier because they had the mounted boards, and they were for about the same price. And so they would end up purchasing the Avalon Hill game, and then when SPI went out of business and the advertising dried up, there was no advertising, and that was another nail into Avalon Hill's coffin. And Greg Costigan has an article, Farewell to Hexes, which gives some additional insight and talking about it in the last 24 hours, we think that no one has a real answer other than not recruiting enough young people into the hobby that why wargaming is where it is today. But it's certainly going through a minor renaissance right now. Now, this is the point of why Avalon Hill died. And there's a series of quotes from the reunion. None of the ownership played games. One panel member said, "The owners were never gamers. They did not value the product that they sold. They had no appreciation for games." One described the family as oblivious to gaming. Eric Dott's son, Jack, who took over for Eric towards the very end of Avalon Hill, he said to one staffer late in the life of the company that real bright people don't want to read. Real bright people don't want to read.
Boy, did you miss that part, huh?
One basic issue was that Monarch leadership thought that they could sell games, and as I witnessed and heard personally from Steve Skelly, the hatchet man there, that, quote, "just like you, undershirts or underwear, that's how you sell games." Now, in the end, Hasbro wanted to buy the rights to Diplomacy and Civilization, and the Dot said they could only have those rights if they bought the whole company, because they wanted out. By then, a new game from Avalon Hill might sell 2,000 copies. And as Costigan pointed out in his article, I can't remember if it was Advanced Squadron or Squadron.
Basic Squadron.
Basic Squadron sold 200,000 copies. My Bismarck, I know, sold more than 25,000 copies, and then we'll get into the print run in a second, but yeah, I think it sold close to 50.
A lot of their early games.
Luftwaffe.
So I worked for Luftwaffe for a lot of years. Well, Luftwaffe was his game. Yes. And you'll love this. When they offered him a game, they said, "We'll give you royalties for 5 years. Most games didn't last 5 years. Or we'll give you something for life." He took the five-year thing, and he found out later that Luftwaffe was a perennial top 20 seller in the Avalon Hill line up until almost the end of Avalon Hill.
Which has also been blamed for why a lot of people buy one copy of Luftwaffe and never play another war game.
I've heard that argument more than once too, yet they redesigned it just recently.
And didn't the
I don't think it was that bad of a game itself.
Yeah.
It wasn't that bad of a game. I'm sure Lou wrote it in Lou style, which meant it probably turned off a lot of people because he was a staff sergeant in the Air Force.
Yes, he was.
I guarantee you that the way he wrote those rules probably turned off more than a few people.
Well, I'm going to finish up this. Oh, I'm sorry.
One thing regarding Luftwaffe, the way my dad played it and so on, and I saw many games ruined by this, is that there is no stacking unless otherwise allowed by the rules.
Yeah, and it sounds like a loop.
Yeah.
And that's not mentioned in any game, with or without stacking.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
This is really crazy.
It is.
Well, another thing that helped bring about the demise was stupid lawsuits. And I better talk, I might as well bring it up now. So I think probably the first real lawsuit involving games, and I could be wrong on this, was my Bismarck. What happened is Bismarck came out in 79, and shortly thereafter, SSI went into business. They did two war games. I can't remember the second one, but the first one that got out was Bismarck. The
second one was Shiloh.
Shiloh? Okay. Yeah. And
which was also involved in a lawsuit, but not with Avalon Hill.
SBI?
With Richard Berg.
Richard Berg, okay. Well, I was completely divorced from Avalon Hill at this point. I mean, I didn't have any royalties. I paid a lump sum when the game was finished by Mick Yule. And anyway, Mick apparently, in a couple of the fantasy scenarios, hypothetical scenarios, where we had American ships, but apparently mislabeled, like probably the Augusta heavy cruiser, and he called it a CL, and there was something else that was a CL, and he called it a CA. Well, the kicker was SSI, when they ripped the design off, didn't catch those mistakes yet. So when those mistakes showed up, Avalon Hill went to SSI, and SSI, having a smart lawyer, said we have to settle out of court. They settled out of court. So here's the point. Avalon Hill won that case, okay? Well, then they decided to sue MicroProse over Civilization, saying, oh, they have the same title. It's a ripoff, just like what happened to Jack Green's Bismarck, right? Yes, and a point I made is that, they had, both had Sumerians and Egyptians, but not much else in common. So apparently there was at least one other lawsuit that they lost that I know of, and I can't remember the details, and there have probably been others. But as we all know, if you're starting to do that kind of stuff, you've got lawyers who are making a lot of money, and you guys, if you're not winning the case, you're not making anything. Now, kind of going in a little bit of, that was pretty much the reunion, but I just wanted to say a few other things that came up. Now, I always had somewhat positive thoughts for Eric, who had me over for family Thanksgiving when I first arrived in August, September, and I was the only employee at their Thanksgiving dinner, which was, you know, and Jack Dott at that point was a teenager. And Tom technically ran the company, but Don was also the main engine, where Randy was a very early hire, and these two were the two most creative parts of the business. But now later, Frank Davis, who did Frederick the Great, he did virtually no work during his employment. The guy literally would say, well, you know, I will best work at night. And so he'd go down to the office at night when nobody was there, go into his office, actually go downtown, I think, too, sometimes, and also call his girlfriend up in New York, to the point where Steve Skelly, the hatchet man, would come down every once in a while and go up to Don and say, where are we getting these tremendous $500 telephone bills? You know, what the heck's going on down here? And so later they actually had a guy hired who moved into the office where, well, not moved into, but where he worked at night also. So what Frank did at that point is he locked the frigging door so nobody could come into his office, so he could do damn well as he pleased. Well, at the end, and this is a true story, I got this from Don, that Frank got a new job, and he went up to Eric Dott, and he said that I cheated you out of a paycheck. And Eric, he said, I haven't done anything for you as long as I've been here at the company. Well, Eric apparently then offered him a raise to stay. I mean, I think this kind of gives you a sense of the management skills here, right?
Exactly. What?
Yeah. Now, as I commented, I had actually been asked about Frank Davis, and I knew his Frederick the Great design was a good game, and I recommended Frank, so I kind of felt a little bad about that. You know, it's like, geez. As Dana knows, we've been old friends for a long, long time. I sometimes pick the wrong horse. Keith Poulter maybe springs to mind. Now, Kevin Zucker was not a high producer either, but he finally did get The Struggle of Nations out in the print. And then one wag there at the convention said of Alan Moon that he would see somebody else's game, reinvent it, and put his name on it, and have it out in 3 months. Now, Alan, when he came on board, came on right at the time when Randy Reed was leading the charge to try to get higher wages. And the reason I left in 76 was over money. We're not talking about a lot. And it gets back to the original point where Don took you aside and said, you're going to work for low wages here under poor management. Well, Randy was leading the charge to get higher wages for the staff, and he actually got physical with Alan Moon because he was viewing Alan Moon as a strike breaker. Now, Randy Reed. Randy was and remains very interesting. A very, very, very emotional man. There's a story about his broken glasses, which will remain for another day. And he and Don definitely dominated the office. Now, Randy was a very non-typical war gamer, and not a pear-shaped war gamer. And yes, there's a story here, too, that involves Steve Peake's first wife. Steve Peake was a battle line and then later a Kinto. And he's one of the funniest war gamers. One time we had Steve Peake and Richard Berg in a bar room at one of the conventions. And I mean, there's 8 or 9 or 10 of us, and we just all stood back and watched those two shoot the barbs across. And it was just too bad no one had a recorder. But she coined the phrase back in the old days that war gamers were pear-shaped. Though the one I heard today was an older, bearded, fat guy.
Fat beards,
there we go. Yeah. And she said that they also came out of a literal closet for a convention, and that's why they were so non-tan. Now, the first funeral I ever attended was Randy's mom's, who died from cancer. And Randy gave a heartfelt talk at that funeral, and obviously I've never forgotten that. I mean, he really did a good job, and it was a new experience for me. And Randy was my friend at court, and then got me the job at Avalon Hill. And I was roommate until his wedding.
I heard through the grapevine that an SPI guy said that I was Randy Reed's bat boy. Well, I wasn't that. I mean, it wasn't, you know, helping him do his work. I mean, they gave me the Bismarck assignment, and that's what I worked on when I was working part-time upstairs. The way it worked is I worked at the print shop for my, you know, 8 hours, occasionally overtime, and then I'd go upstairs and work for another couple of 3 hours, and that's where I got my overtime for Avalon Hill. I've always considered Randy a creative game designer, The Longest Day, 1776. Now, he also worked on Tobruk, and I argued with him at the time about the billiard board game table. If you remember Tobruk, there was no terrain features. And he finally got talked into it where I think he rolled the die, and if it was a six or maybe it was 10-sided, I don't recall, that, well, there was a depression there on the map board. You know, you got a tank in it. And he was also key, Randy was, in getting Vance von Borries' Air Assault on Crete game published. And that was the first real war game that Vance ever had published. And Vance, of course, has been a wonderful addition to the industry, in my opinion, over the decades. And he's still publishing. Richard Berg recently wrote to me about Randy. The first review I ever wrote and published was for 1776. And two days after it hit the streets, I got a rather heated call from Randy Reed. Avalon Hill's game philosophy was different from SPI's, and we don't need to go into that here. But and we just didn't see eye to eye on anything was an understatement. And he and Randy were never friends. But Richard goes on, he does have some great stories about Blackbeard. And the Dots had great seats for the Euro games. And that's one thing the Dots did do, is they had a plethora of sports team tickets. And I did get to see the Orioles when I was back there, and they were very nice seats. I know at one point he was taking Rex Martin and his wife, and Eric and his wife would go out to dinner on a regular basis, and then at some point Rex Martin said something about the way the company was being run or something like that. And guess what? No more dinners. Well, Randy was always involved with attractive women. And at his bachelor party with Richard Hamlin, Mick Yule, and myself, we ate crab at a Baltimore place. Don Notice was not present. The couple next to us overheard our conversation, which was very much about shop. And it turned, and as I turned over, there's a very attractive gal and her boyfriend. They bent over and they said, "Yeah, we play Panzerblitz. We play Panzerblitz all the time." And I proposed marriage to her on the spot. Turning to the Russian campaign, John Edwards was from Melbourne. And he was tied in with John Morgan. And do you remember John Morgan? He was an Anglo-Aborigine ex-policeman from Melbourne. And he was the junior partner for the Russian campaign. And he later married an American and worked for Iron Crown for quite some time. Now, Edwards took the relative success of Jebco and ended up buying a bar in Melbourne, and there fades from history. We don't know where he is today. Now, it's been recorded in the General, the Russian campaign did not relatively sell well, no 100,000 units. Maybe like Bismarck, I'm going to guess 50,000 units. But it had the first McGowan cover for a game, certainly at Avalon Hill. And even when he was told not to do it, Roger McGowan placed his name on the cover. And if you have that game, you can find it. And it was the first Avalon Hill cover to have a name on it, like a painting or a poster. But that's just another example of how Monarch was an old-style, stodgy East Coast company and didn't really know how to handle artists. And guys like Roger, Don, Randy were artists to one degree or another. You know, if I recall correctly, I think in a lot of the early games, they didn't even list the designer. So if you go back to Africa Corps, or you won't see Tom Shaw's name listed as a designer.
Yeah, Tom didn't get listed other than I think on the
sports games.
Because those were his babies.
And he actually brought them to Avalon Hill.
Yep.
See, while I was at Avalon Hill, I was sent a copy of 1829 from my dear friend Andrew Smith. And 1829 was done by the two red-headed brothers who went on to do the first Civilization game. And to me, the 18XX games are the best games that have been designed, that are paper cardboard. We played it to the office, AH liked it, and it got morphed into 1830. So that's a little claim to history there. Okay, now we come to how they printed them. In the 70s, we would print 25,000 copies of a game.
but they would only be assembled in groups of 5,000. Possibly the initial group might be 10,000, but when they were running out of stock, they would put together 5,000 games. And there would be a literal row of mostly black women as the conveyor belt rolled by. One would put in the counters, another the map, another the dice, and they'd be put into inventory upon completion. Now, about that time, Don Greenwood, who'd been there for several years, noted to me that he did not know how many copies of The General were printed. The next day at work, I contacted the printer who ran that press, and voila, we had the answer. That gives you another sense of the division.
What was the number?
You know, I was trying to think. I think it was either 7,000 or 11,000. And that would have been, you know, 75, 76. And Custodian in his article says that the S&T surpassed The General. I think he overestimated how many copies of The General were going out. So, but I can't prove that.
I believe in the 80s, probably putting out 15 to 20 consistently.
Well, that would have passed The General.
S&T? S&T was ahead. Advertising and Playboy never hurt them. They got a lot of, believe it or not, they got a lot of subscriptions from that. I've talked to people who were there, and Playboy got them a lot of business.
The highest circulation, they published the circulation in every issue of S&T. The highest one was 30,500 issue number 69.
Mm-hmm. Huh. Don Greenwood emailed me this just a few days ago. Life is strange. I was in a constant state of disbelief over what I saw at Avalon Hill. Believe me, Jack, you were there during the good years. It got a whole lot worse. Even now, I don't dare speak out publicly about how the place was run. People would consider me the biggest liar who ever lived. It was simply unbelievable. Then again, with what I see is going on in the world today, I begin to think the entire world is mad. There's no such thing as normal. So, I have here, and if you're interested, I'll offer it to you. This was published in September 1964. General was my first thing that I ever had published. I was probably 13. Dear Sirs, issue number 3 of The General.
Volume 1, issue 3.
Let's hear it for the Punic Wars. Let's hear more for Napoleon. According to Mr. Hill, Marlborough never lived and Blenheim was never fought. Let's hear it for World War I. Yeah, long live Gustavus Adolphus. Mr. Avalon, have you ever heard of the American War for Independence? Anyway, I go on in that vein, and at the end, Tom Shaw, who I assume edited, left the E off my name. anyway, that's pretty much what I wanted to say. I'd be happy to take any questions.
You mentioned that one of the prime movers of this reunion was the passing of Craig Taylor. But just a few months earlier, there was the passing of Charles Roberts himself. Did that have any impetus towards this reunion?
No, because we were hoping to get Tom Shaw, but Tom Shaw is apparently still quite physically vigorous, but he just finished going through a hip operation down in Florida, so he sent his regrets. Though I understand he's going to have an interview published next year in 3CI. So he's going to talk a bit about the old times. No, Roberts was actually not really mentioned much because this was all under Eric Dott and the Dott family. So,
and as you said, the only survivor from the Charles Roberts era was Tom Shaw himself.
Yeah, and I suppose indirectly Christy Shaw. Christy worked in his wife, Tom's wife, worked as like special orders, you know. So if you were 14 back in those days and ordered a copy of Africa Corps, she probably packed it and sent it out by you, however they did back in those days. And mentioning Craig Taylor, I worked with Craig Taylor at Battleline. When I left in 76, I got hired that summer by Battleline to do a game that I never list in any of my credits. That I worked on as a developer is Objective Atlanta. And I was basically handed a done map sheet and a finished counter sheet. And it wasn't the campaign of
Atlanta in 1864. It was how you're going to supply the armies in 1864. I think there was almost as many supply counters as there were combat units. I mean, it was the only game this guy ever did, which is probably good for the hobby as a whole. And I think I even refused to have my name put on the credit for that game, which is the only one. You could argue there's a couple others I should have done the same thing, including some of my own designs. But Objective Atlanta did not know very well. But I got to know Craig there, and then I got to know Craig at the conventions. And when we went back to Larry Hoffman and I went back to Origins 1, we played Wooden Ships and Ironmen in the tournament. Larry ended up fourth, and I ended up second. So we got to meet Steve Peake and Craig Taylor there and get to know him quite well, which is why I think I probably was tapped to come down. Anyway, to finish my comments about Craig Taylor, I always knew him as just a very nice, jovial type guy. And at Battleline, one of the things that they did is they always put a joke on every map sheet. So if you play the Battleline flat top, if you look carefully, you can find Kong Island, where King Kong is, and has no effect on the game. And then they did a game on the Seven Pines 1862 campaign. That was their first game that they put out. There's a racetrack on the map sheet, the Richmond racetrack, you know, horse racing. That's just a little joke that they put in. I actually adopted it. I usually, in my books, when I write them, somewhere they're in the introduction or whatever, there's a fake name. George L. Tirebiter is acknowledged in one of my books. Tire, T-Y-R-E, and if you know Fire Sign Theater, you know where that came from. And but what I found out at the convention is apparently he had a temper. And it was more than two guys told me the story, that one of them said that they were walking to say talk to Craig in his office, and at that moment a chair flew across the office and they just did a 180 and went back to their room and said they'd come back and talk to him later. And the other story was, you know, roughly the same, was that he was a yeller and a bit of a screamer. The poor guy, who was a big man. He never married, and just a sweet man too, but. Apparently he had a pizza delivery. Oh, the other thing is Don Greenwood and he ate cheeseburgers every day the whole time he was there for lunch. I'm sure there was a couple of exceptions. And those cheeseburgers I'm sure got to him because he wasn't that old when he passed. I want to say he was probably in his early 60s. But they delivered a pizza on Friday, and when nobody heard from him, somebody went over, I guess, Saturday night, and they found that he'd had a massive heart attack and died in his home. So... And the poor gal, the secretary, who again I never knew, she was at the funeral for memorial service for Craig Taylor, and Don was there, and she suggested, you know, we should have a reunion. And anyway, she died a few weeks later from breast cancer. So
Jack, what you're saying is that Avalon Hill was run by people that didn't play games and didn't like them, that hired people who basically did no work and took the money, and had two people who had anger management issues on top of it. Right? So this is the culture, the corporate culture of Avalon Hill. Is that what you're saying?
There was certainly an element of it. And Mick was a very good worker. Richard Hamlin was a very good worker. The secretary who he married, Carol, was very good. And there's a story there. Richard Hamlin. Richard actually had three sets of clothes, and he kept some in Maine. And what he did, he was one of these guys whose weight fluctuated tremendously. I mean, he literally at one point weighed over 400 pounds, and he could drop down to 200 pounds, and that's why he had three sets of clothes. And he was a big man when he was at Avalon Hill, but not that big. He wasn't in his large size. And Carol was this little, I mean, she couldn't have been more than 97 pounds, and she worked, she got it as a late hire, she was a secretary front office, so to speak. And all of a sudden, one day, they announced their engagement. And I mean, I've always appreciated I'm usually pretty good at seeing things like that going on, you have an office romance or something, you know, I got good radar. I didn't have a clue. Don says that he sensed that there was something going on, but it took me completely by surprise. And they're still together, which was sweet. But Richard intends to come out with some more game designs. And the other thing is, Richard he drank so much coffee, there was one time where he collapsed in the office. And it was to caffeine overload. I mean, it was just a whole pot after another and after another.
Avalon Hill sold 27,000 copies of Guadalcanal, and they thought it was a horrible, horrible seller. Now, I'm sure if Dana sold a game that sold 27,000 copies, we'd see him doing cartwheels.
So I can make the mortgage.
So given that like print runs now are like 12, perhaps as low as 800 or 1,200.
Some as high as 5,000.
Yeah. Do you think the pricing model is not, as you said, underwear and shirts, but now more like collectible prints or limited edition books?
Actually, I think there's a fair point there. The other thing is that the older we've gotten, most of us have more disposable income. Mm-hmm. And whereas, I mean, I've spoken to a couple of people just here at this convention who you said, well, I played games, war games or whatever, when I was in my teens and my early college. And then when I got out of college and I got married and I had a kid and I was working and I got out of it. But now I'm 45 or 55 and my kids are gone and an empty nester, and guess what? I'm making four times what I was making when I was 22. So there is that aspect. It is amazing that there is, for a lot of people in the business, a fair amount of disposable income, which we didn't have when we were younger.
Well, I think that you've got a lot of games out here that are Euro games that are $50, $60, $70, $80, mm-hmm. and people buy them. I think what hurt wargaming more than anything else is When I started, how many rules were there to Africa? Or four pages.
Yeah.
Four pages, right? And there was like, what, a couple dozen counters. So, you know, we used to joke about being able to get right after school, we could play the game and get it. And okay, you won that one, let's do it again, right? I mean, when you pick up games today, war games, right? Unless they're like Victory Point stuff, which have a limited number of rules, you're talking 32 pages, 48 page rule book, right? I mean, you can't even start to play the game until you've read this amount of stuff, right? And plus, there's a complexity level that, quite frankly, I don't think was necessary. I think, you know, really good game design is being able to put in the most important information into a game and then let the players make the important decisions. You know, I don't have to be the guy deciding how much spaghetti to take to North Africa, right? on top of which unit's going to attack in this
Amen.
Battle, right?
Amen.
So I think that a lot of the problems that wargaming suffers from were self-inflicted. And I remember the one thing, I had a big debate about this, when SPI was the hot dog company. I mean, it really was trying to outproduce Avalon Hill, and their magazine was surveying their readers, right? And what happened is, I said right at the time, the only people who are going to respond to this are the hardcore, right? So they kept asking for more obscure games, right? They don't want to hear Gettysburg over and over again. And they wanted more complexity, right? That's the only guys that are sitting. So what do? They dutifully took this information and they gave you more obscure games with lots more rules. And then, you know, the magazine started going like this. And their sales went like this. And I said, duh, right? It's like, you can't... Yes, you should pay attention to your fans. You should absolutely listen to your customers. But when they're asking for you to move away from what got you them in the first place, then you have to think, well, you know, maybe there should be two series here. You know, one that's you keep to keep people coming in.
The hardcore.
Right.
Something that appeals to the grognard.
And also something for the person who's the beginner, right?
Yeah.
And quite frankly, you know, I've actually gone more that direction with some of the designs I'm working on. You know, I'm one of the worst offenders. Streets of Stalingrad. It's like, you know, come on. He's like, take your 2,000 counters. Shut them up. After 3 days, let me know if you're ready. Right? I appreciate the people who say I love that game and I really think it's a wonderful game, et cetera, et cetera. But the bottom line is that's one of the reasons why our hobby was hurt so badly.
Tell you that Streets of Stalingrad, the original Phoenix
yes.
edition,
yes.
the one that you killed two companies.
Yes, I did.
That game is one of only two monster games where I have personally played every single scenario
at
least
God.
Once.
What's the other one?
Frank Chadwick's Citadel by GDW.
Wow.
Okay.
That's impressive. Thank you.
What's the title? What was Citadel about?
It was about the siege of Dien Bien Phu.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, that was interesting. Yeah.
Anyway, so what I'm getting at is, if I were to do another Stalingrad right now, what I would actually do is something like a victory point game. Okay, where it's division level. All right, and the city's this long. Okay. Right? No, honestly, yeah, really. Yeah, because what happens is people want to play Stalingrad and they want to see what it's like. But what you get to do when you go to division level is, one of the things in my lecture Saturday was, you know, the Soviets were scared to death the Germans were going to jump across the river and cut off the city, which was make the most sense of everything, right? But that never happened historically. In my game, you can't do that because it's just about the city fighting. Well, if you do a game like I just said, you can actually explore more what-ifs. And there's only going to be, 20 counters on the German side and maybe twice as many on the Russian side. But the point is that you could play that game in a shorter time and you could teach somebody much faster also, okay? So what I'm concentrating on now is actually going the other direction in terms I'm going away from a Streets of Stalingrad. I don't think I'll ever do, from scratch, a game like that. We're actually thinking of doing a new edition.
Because there's interest for it. But right, that would be doing that other.
But my time, I can crank out like 20 victory point level games at least in the same time it would take me to make another, you know, major game with hundreds of counters, for example. And I think it'll reach more people and have a better chance to get someone involved. The other thing are the quality of the components. I mean, we're all, you know, most of the people I would assume here are cardboard counter guys. You know, that's what we grew up with. And so we can handle that. But boy, when you look at these games out here with the plastic pieces, they are terrific. And the irony is that it used to be almost impossible to afford that, like in the old days of Avalon Hill. You couldn't put that in there. Now you can afford to have custom dice. You can have plastic pieces, and you can have cards, because remember, you're selling the game at $60, $70, $80. Well, if you do that, and you give people a box full of little plastic soldiers or, you know, whatever. Exactly. And that's what I think we needed to do with war games is, okay, guys still want to play cardboard, sure. But Frank showed me his latest game on the Golan Heights from Victory Point. Okay, it's die cut, but have you seen what Alan has done with this game? Is that they're laser cut? They're really thick.
With no burn marks.
Right. So what he showed me is the air attack marker, like ground attack, right? You punch out two things, they go into each other, and they stand upright. So you have like a die cut counter that actually is three-dimensional, that doesn't lay flat. And you move it around on the
board. And it's an air, and it's.
Yes, and then he also has some damage markers that are like little explosions, and they're cut that way. So they're not like just a square. Well, at least that gives you a little more variety and interest. You know, it's more interesting than just all square or rectangular counters. I mean, I really got disappointed about the 1980s and 90s because I was out of it for a while. I was doing other things that I, you know, wasn't even involved. And I came back and I said, damn, the whole industry's been frozen for the past 15 years. I mean, these look exactly the same. I was hoping to see new, exciting ideas. And the only people who did that were like Fantasy Flight and other guys, and the Euro games had come up. And I thought, we used to borrow from each other all the time. No one was upset with that. No one got upset that you took something from somebody that was a good idea, because you can't copyright that, mm-hmm. right? And yet, all these Euro games came up, and all these really cool-looking games, like the Lord of the Rings out there, and it's like, where is that for? Access Analysis was probably one of the only ones that did that, you know, where they had little plastic pieces, it was a general game. Yeah, it wasn't super historically accurate, but my God, they sell 100,000 of those every year, right?
Well, look at the additions that they've...
Larry Harris has been cranking a nice guy machine in his garage.
You could get the economy of scale. The trouble is that if you have die-cut counters, a sheet of 200 half-inch die-cut counters, which was the standard for an SPI S&T game,
right.
That die had 288 inches of cutting surface.
Right.
And to make that die, if you went to a die maker, it would cost you about $100 an inch. But after you had that die and you started whacking out mounted counter sheets, you could whack them out at 75 a minute.
Right, right.
Whereas if you go to so that has a huge upfront cost, like a railroad, but after it's done, they're essentially free.
You want to make as much money as you can, absolutely.
Yeah. So if you go to the other end with Alan Emmerich and his laser, let's say that laser has 120 inches of linear travel per minute, but he also loses 2 seconds every time he has to make a pierce point. And he has to have a pierce point for each counter so that there's a nub to hold it. Now maybe he can optimize it so he only has 100 pierce points. But whereas if you make that upfront tooling cost, the die cut sheets are coming out at 75 a minute. It takes Alan Emmerich, because he has to pierce point it, he doesn't have any of that upfront tooling cost, but he still has, it takes him 5 minutes to do the counter sheet,
right.
One counter sheet.
Right, right.
Now the advantage that he can have unlimited flexibility in his counter sheet, he doesn't have inventory or spoilage issues, he doesn't have to worry about optimizing his lift, so he has to gang print like 5 games at a time, which is what Decision Games does with their
magazines. Or GMT.
Or GMT.
That's what MMP does. MMP has to gang print everything.
Yeah.
Because your counter sheets have to be X.
So now that we have the model where we're at limited edition books rather than games, it makes sense for Alan to do that. If Alan, I don't believe, could survive let's say some Victory Point game actually won a Spiel des Jahres. That's the only industry award that actually translates into sales. You win a Spiel des Jahres, you are guaranteed 50,000 units in sales. So let's say Alan Emmerich had a Victory Point game that won a Spiel des Jahres. He immediately gets those 50,000 orders. He could not fill that order with his current tooling setup. He'd have to go to hard tooling, which takes a year's lead time.
No. I don't know if it takes that long. I've seen guys quicker than that. I grant you, back in the 80s.
Yeah, well, okay.
If he gets the orders, I'll just get another laser.
If he gets... Yeah, but, the laser is like the die cutter. Lasers have, they cost you $100 in burden. They have, and they do that 168 hours a week. So unless you're cutting burning 168
hours a week... Well, Mark, let me put it this way. I would like to have that problem.
It's a great problem to have.
As a follow-on, he now has a company called Victory Point Services, or Victory Point Bank Services, that rents time on the laser.
Yeah.
So I think MMP has taken advantage of that and had them
cut
the counters.
Right. Oh, wow.
That means he's got capacity.
Until he's working lights out or 168 hours a week, he does not have a capacity problem. He has a staffing problem.
And
you're right. That's a problem I'd love to have.
I was going to say, and let's be honest, guys, 100,000 Access and Allies, that's considered a bad seller.
Yeah.
For Hasbro, man. Yeah,
that's true.
100,000 in a year is considered a bad seller. Because they look at what Monopoly sells.
Yeah, but because Hasbro...
We're excited by 100,000 units.
If you think a steel rule die is expensive,
oh, I know.
That's an injection molded plastic die.
I know how expensive
So instead of $10,000 for a steel rule die, you now have $100,000 for an injection mold die. But once again, you get 300 of those perfectly detailed pieces.
Yep. Well, I think having worked with a dice guy, Luzaki, I got to listen to all his complaints about injection molding in dice. And let me tell you, it not only is it expensive, but it's downright insane what you have to do to recover your cost. If you're not selling, to recover the cost for the 20-sided die mold took him, if he had done it differently, it would have been faster, but it took him 5 years.
And they weren't that pretty looking of dice.
And he got them everywhere. His dice were in D&D. Those were his dice, for committee's sakes. It still took him 5 years to recover his cost for a 20-sided mold.
And all of that's an upfront cost.
That's right.
Yeah.
And when I got there in 1989, and he was getting the 100-sided die finalized. He Once he got it done, he had to go get, he went and had to get orders so he could show the guy who was making the mold that it was worth his while to finish it. They were at that point. Now, luckily, people stepped up and ordered enough, but when he did 100-sided dice after that, unless he had orders for 100,000, he did not box. He waited until he had 100,000 built up. And guess what? That leads to, at that time, annoyed customers, because customer dynamic was very different in 1990, 1991, 1992. But, you know, we did dice, we got them in 55-gallon drums.
Jeez.
Because they didn't, you could do whatever color you wanted. If you told them, I want 5,000 blue, 5,000 this, 5,000, that's fine. The color didn't matter, but you had to get, we got 10 drums at a time. Yeah, 10 drums at a time.
25 years ago, if you wanted to have a game that had standard playing cards, you know, with round corners, like they have in every card-driven game, you had two choices. The first choice was to buy a card machine like the ones they use at U.S. Game Systems for about $125,000, or you had to farm it out to U.S. Game Systems, and they'd print it for you, but their minimum order was 250,000 decks.
Yep.
Now, with the evolution of on-target manufacturing, you can have, like GMT, have a run of 5,000 and make 10,000 decks and actually have it be feasible. Because with the distribution model of wargaming, which is 40-10-2, 50-10-2, you still need to have a suggested retail price that's six times your cost of goods sold.
That's actually better than one in my days. It was 7-1, and D&D was 10-1.
Mm-hmm. You know, and I will tell you, from sitting at the distribution end with a partial distributor manufacturer, it's very entertaining. Lou refused to do anything that didn't get him a 10-1 return. It didn't matter. That was his minimum. He had to, his manufacturing end, 10-1 return. Now, we got 10-1 on those dice. I will tell you that flat out. We actually got closer to 15.
Wow.
On other things, 10-1 is hard, because he did his Battle of Britain game, which he wanted to redo. He found out he couldn't make it anywhere near what he wanted to do, so he said, damn, I'll make a supplement that I can at least make 10-1 on. He refused to look at anything that didn't give him a 10-1 return. Refused. What's very interesting is, as Magic is being pushed around the industry in 93, they asked everybody in the industry to invest. They did. They went to everybody. They asked Lou for $5,000, which isn't a lot of money, by the way. $5,000. That's all he had to have invested. $5,000. He said, he asked me, and I said, you know, Lou, this is a pretty innovative game. I think it's going to sell. I think we're going to sell a lot. He's like, okay. And he took my opinion, and then he asked somebody else who gave him a totally horrible opinion, and he didn't invest the $5,000. But Wayne at War Games West saw the potential and dropped close to 50. So he got the best allocation initially. But they asked everybody in the industry.
Well, I've got a story about this.
They didn't ask that much. They made five or 10. That's it.
What's your story, Jack?
So I went to school in Whitman College, Walla Walla, Washington. Little broad school. Okay, and if your memories are all sharp here, Magic is connected to the state of Washington, okay? Well, I go back to my reunions, and I go by and see my history department teachers, and they're all gone now, but this is, probably 15 years ago, maybe longer. The professor in question has since passed, but he had this great story. They had a chair open, and they had a math professor come in for a year at the chair. He was a young guy, very popular, did the two semesters. And as he was getting ready to leave out the front door, because they couldn't hire him for another year, he goes, you know, I've been working on this game. And his specialty was comparative math. It was some form of comparative math, or, you know, interrelationship with numbers and stuff, which... And all the professors said, oh, no, we don't think we want to invest in anything like this. You know, no, we don't want to invest in anything like this. And, of course, it was the brain.
It was a math problem to him. That's how he did magic. He did magic as a math problem. And
lo and behold, he came up with something pretty innovative.
Well,
but he's actually more proud of Robo Rally.
What now? What's that?
It's a little programmable robot.
It's a programmable movement race
robot
game. Yeah,
with robots. He loved that even more because it was more. It was more of his math. Mm-hmm. Magic was made of the money. Yeah. Robo Rally was a pride game. You know, one of those things where he did it for joy.
Yeah.
But he was a very interesting person. Yeah, it was kind of funny because I'm sitting there looking at his bio. It's like, oh, you're a math professor. That explains so much. It really explains so much about the game.
Peter Atkinson added the collectible aspect, because Peter Atkinson's a big baseball card guy.
Oh, yeah, I know.
Wait a minute. Why don't we, call, instead of a Honus Wagner card, we'll call it a Black Lotus, and instead of...
the Power 9, the infamous Power 9, those cards shot up in value fast.
Yeah.
But, yeah, that the entry is so different.
I get to go home.
All right, well.
Most of us would be happy to be.
Let's say thank you to Jack for everything.